Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Music and the Global Order. This talk is delivered by Dr. Martin Stokes, world-famous ethnomusicologist from St. John's College, Oxford University.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this session of the seminar series Work in Progress in the Social Studies. And good evening also to our radio audience on Campus FM. Before I introduce tonight's speaker, I'd just like to let you know that after the Easter vacation, we look forward to seminars by Professor Roger Just from the University of Kent, who will be exploring changing patterns of kinship in Southern Europe. And we also look forward to two works in progress by postgraduate students, by Mrs. Elise Billiard-Pisani, who will be speaking about the development of food and material culture in Malta, and is working on her PhD for the University of Aix-Marseille. And we look forward to a seminar by Ms. Sharon Attard, who is proposing doctoral research in anthropology on a topic which I think is of interest to many people and which many people feel is perhaps underexplored. That is the anthropology of children and child development. Well, now I'd like to introduce very warmly tonight's speaker. We are very fortunate to have a man who is introducing to Malta, the University of Malta, and our seminar series, a very, very new subject and theme, which I'm sure we all want to know much more about. That is the subject of ethnomusicology. And now our speaker tonight is Dr. Martin Stokes, University lecturer in ethnomethodology at the University of Oxford and fellow of St. John's College, Oxford. Martin has been director of the Middle Eastern Studies Center at the University of Chicago. He is well known within anthropological circles for having written The Arabesque Debate, Music and Musicians in Modern Turkey. This is his exploration of the reaction of anti-nationalists to the development of secularism and nationalism in Turkey. Dr. Stokes has also edited Music, Ethnicity, and Identity, and with P.V. Bowman, he has edited Celtic Modern, Music on the Global Fringe. Martin won the Jap Kunst Prize from the Society for Ethnomusicology in 2005 for the best article in ethnomusicology. It was based on his article, Music and the Global Order, which was published by Annual Review of Anthropology. Tonight, Dr. Stokes is going to be speaking to us about popular culture and the Islamist movement in Turkey. So a warm welcome to Martin Stokes.
Thank you very much, Paul, for that kind and warm welcome. Thank you, Simon, and all at the Mediterranean Institute for generously inviting me and hosting me. Thank you, Philip Cantar, for being a great host and dealing with all of the practicalities. So thank you, Philip, very much indeed. It really is a great pleasure and an honor to be here. This is my second visit to Malta. I came here as a teenager on holiday once, so not long ago, of course. This is already a place of all sorts of discoveries, one of which, interestingly enough, as Paul explained, I'm an ethnomusicologist who has worked on both Turkish and Arab music as well throughout my career as an ethnomusicologist, and I think it was in Malta back in 1979 that I discovered Tunisian music. It was very easy to listen to on the radio, and I have quite intense memories actually of sitting in my parents' rental car and listening to the radio broadcasts from Tunis. Now I realize I was listening to the broadcast of the Rashidiya Institute, but I didn't know that then. It was just an exotic sound that rather caught my fancy. I made another discovery today, which is, I think, one of the most succinct definitions and exemplifications of what one might call practical postmodernism. If one goes down to the harbour and observes, I think it's Captain Morgan's harbor tours on offer is an opportunity to, and I quote, witness 7,000 years of turbulent Maltese history in 15 minutes. There was something about that phrase that really caught my fancy, and I thought, well, here is the very essence of what the postmodern mindset is. To, of course, not to understand, a call not to understand history, but to quote-unquote witness it, and of course to boil down 7,000 years of turbulent history into 15 minutes. I thought that was perfect definition of where we are in this quote-unquote postmodern age. Philip, let me know very, very kindly about the sad death of your colleague, Charles Camilleri, not so long ago, and it was a nice opportunity for myself to learn a few things about him and to remind myself that I actually was more familiar than I first thought with his work. A very famous composer, of course, but a lot of English school kids who take their grade 5 piano know his Cantilena. It's really quite a well-known piece in our part of the world. I discovered reading, he was obituarized. His obituaries appeared in the Independent and in the Guardian in England, two papers that I read on a daily basis. And I, of course, I learned a lot of things, not only about him, but also about academic musicology here in Malta. I discovered that he was the first professor of music here. I discovered that he was a composer who was very much oriented towards Maltese folklore in quite interesting ways. I learned that he composed the first Maltese opera. I discovered a few things about his, I think there were three piano concertos, the second of which is called Makan. And I gather that he had family connections in Tunis, and that this was based on some experience of having visited Tunisia and listen to Makan music there. He's the author, I discovered, of several books and articles, but there was a book on the Mediterranean, which I gather appeared quite recently. I haven't been able to get my hands on it, but I intend to, in which he presents a vision of Mediterranean culture, very much stressing the connectedness of the Mediterranean through music. I get the picture of somebody who's Mediterranean, very much like Fernand Braudel's, was capable of almost infinite expansion, a Mediterranean that was capable in some sense of reaching out and, as it were, touching not only every corner of the Mediterranean, but the whole world beyond. So Camilleri was clearly somebody with a global vision of things, a cosmopolitan vision of things. This was clearly a man who, of artistic fantasies, and I don't use the word fantasy in a negative sense here, but artistic fantasies of connectedness, of communication across boundaries, and of the recognition of sharedness in culture. I mean, that's the picture that I get of this person's view of the Mediterranean and of Mediterranean music, and I'm very much looking forward to, as a result partly of this experience and partly of the little reading that I've done, of finding out more about somebody who is obviously a very important guy. Another thing that crossed my mind as I was assembling these thoughts was an article by anthropologist Anna Singh, recently published and republished in various places. It's quite an extensive critique of globalization theory as understood both by the critical left and the neoliberal right. According to Anna Tsing, both left and right these days see in quote-unquote globalization the triumph of Anglo-Saxon economics, and both left and right have a view of culture in, quote-unquote, the age of globalization as being either irrelevant to globalization or as a kind of accommodation of globalization, or particularly on the left, as a kind of resistance to globalization. Globalization is understood as this kind of system operating according to its own sort of internal dynamic, that is, we're pushing against human life worlds, and that culture is always in some kind of oppositional relationship to that, whether it, as it were, puts up with it or whether it fights back. One of the reasons that Anna Tsing finds this view of globalization and culture problematic is because it puts, in her view, it puts Anglo-Saxon economics beyond critique. It removes agency, it moves kind of world building, it removes culture from the globalization project, rendering it simply as it were, a kind of mechanical system. And when, of course, and so for her, putting Anglo-Saxon economics beyond critique is, of course, a problematic disposition. Anthropologists, she argued, must focus, by contrast, on what she calls the located specificities of global dreams. She's interested in the actors and the agencies of globalization. She's interested in all of those people and agencies and institutions and groups of people getting together who have, as it were, a scalar vision of things, a global vision of things which they, as it were, want to, which they're trying in various ways to engage and put into practice. So this critique of globalization theory is one that I think I find rather significant and rather interesting and rather important. It's been picked up in my own area of little field of study, ethnomusicology, most recently by an American ethnomusicologist called Tom Torino, who writes both about Africa and about Latin America. And in a recent book about popular music culture in Zimbabwe, he also argues against globalization theory on rather similar grounds. He's very impatient with this picture of globalization, as it were, as something that happens to us, as something that seems to inspire this very passive understanding of what's going on. He says, rather than looking at globalized musicians, he says, let's rather think about cosmopolitan musicians. Rather than thinking about musicians to whom something is happening, i.e. globalization, let's think of them as cosmopolitans, as people who are trying to engage and activate, as it were, musical worlds. And so this, again, is both a critique and a disposition towards globalization, particularly from a musical point of view, that I find rather useful. Musicians, it strikes me, like Charles Camilleri and like, of course, so many others, might very usefully be thought of as active cosmopolitans whose global dreams, whose imaginaries of the world, and attempts to, as it were, imagine the world in these terms, in certain important senses, socially and culturally important senses, make things happen. One might, also by way of preamble, before I start talking about the rather specific things that interest me, one might, I think, imagine an alternative to what I might describe as the conjunctive Mediterranean of cosmopolitans like Camilleri. One might imagine, in opposition to this, a rather different model of the Mediterranean, which I might describe contrastively as a disjunctive model of the Mediterranean. This is a Mediterranean of cultural and political tectonic plates, of fault lines, of major global forces pressing against one another in often rather incendiary and complex and violent fashions. The Mediterranean, according to this model, might be understood as the place where the global rich meet and encounter the global poor, where free markets meet and encounter the remnants of state systems, and of course where Christianity meets Islam. And these encounters are, of course, usually deeply and profoundly uncomfortable occasions in the world that we live in at the moment. Now, this model of the Mediterranean, this disjunctive model of the Mediterranean, also it strikes me as having musical correlates as well. When one tries to understand the Mediterranean musically, one can be, I think, struck as much by the close proximity of different musical systems. One can be struck by the fact that neighbors living very, very close to one another can inhabit musical spaces, acoustic spaces, which are mutually incomprehensible to an extraordinary degree. When one thinks about the musical space that one crosses leaving a country like Malta or somewhere like Sicily and just hopping over a few short miles to the other shore of the Mediterranean, of course, one is, musically speaking, in a very, very different world. So I want to suggest, it's funny how these things just disappear, an alternative picture of the Mediterranean to the kind of conjunctive model that I wanted to, that I started off describing and ventriloquizing in some sense, Charles Camilleri. The ethnomusicologist's task, or the contemporary ethnomusicologist's task, is, I think, in some senses, to recognize both pictures, both of these models, simultaneously in trying to grasp the Mediterranean as a globalized cultural space, as a space in which certain global processes are being forged. So, with these preliminary thoughts in mind, I'd like to say a few words about some of my own recent research, because I gather this is a seminar for research in progress, so this is not written up yet in any meaningful shape or form, but this is what I've been looking at over the last couple of years. As Paul suggested, at the beginning I've been particularly interested in recent years in the Turkish Islamist movement and its music. I should say a few things to start off with about what the Turkish Islamist movement is and what I mean by describing it as a movement in the first place and secondly by describing it as Islamist. So a little bit of just basic and simple history, which unfortunately is far from uncontentious, but nonetheless one needs to present the facts in some order or another, so this is the order that I choose. The Ottoman Empire was collapsing at the end of the 19th century, as you know, and disintegrated at the end of the First World War. The establishment of the secular Turkish Republic took place in 1923 in the hands of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. Turkish Republican modernity was predicated on secularism. This established a fully and a radically secular order. In a space which politically had previously been dominated by the caliphs of Islam. The secular regime held sway more or less without interruption until 1980. Again, this is something of a simplification. There were free elections, there were military coups along the way, but the basic secular order of things really didn't change in a significant way, in my view, until 1980. 1980, the 12th of September 1980, saw a military coup that was underreported in the Western world, but was in fact a bloody and violent affair whose political reverberations were still to be felt a long time afterwards. A civilian prime minister was elected in 1983, and this was Turgut Özal. This began to affect the transition of the country to what one might describe as a neoliberal political order. The state was being dismantled, and the institutions of the free market were being put in its place. Along with the economic liberalization was a political liberalization which opened the door to political movements claiming their political validity from Islam and from religion. In the mid-1990s, the Islamist movements had begun to consolidate and to effect what one might describe as a capture of the municipal and then the state apparatus. So by 1996, Istanbul had both an Islamist mayor and it also had an Islamist prime minister. So since 1996, one could describe the Islamist movement in Turkey as a political movement that is significantly in control, culturally in control, socially in control, politically in control, and so forth. This has been the case more or less without interruption since 1996. In 1999, there was the famous so-called postmodern coup. We keep coming back to postmodernism, don't we? There was the so-called postmodern coup of 1999, in which the military attempted to oust the Islamist government, very much behind closed doors. The military leaders went up to the Islamist leaders and said, "We would truly appreciate it if you guys just stood down and allowed us to take over." And the Islamists said, "Yeah, sure," because there wasn't really very much else that they can do. The Turkish military still is able to play that role. And the so-called postmodern coup, which took place more or less without anybody immediately realizing it, was very quickly reversed. The moment that a new set of elections were put into play, the Islamist powers, the Islamist political parties, under different names, simply occupied the space that they had occupied before. The other thing that I wanted to tell you as regards what the Islamist movement is concerns a transformation of the major Islamist parties, which can be summed up in terms of replacement of first Prime Minister Necmettin Erbakan by Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Necmettin Erbakan, a very flamboyant, politically aggressive person, sought always a confrontation with the secular with the secular political system, and was always, as it were, trying to force the secular system onto the defensive. Necmettin Erbakan retired and was replaced by Turkey's current person, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who was politically much more of a pragmatist and a quietist. Instead of trying to replace the secular public sphere with a religious public sphere, which was Erbakan's project, Erdogan has sought, by contrast, to construct a kind of parallel Islamic universe in the secular state, a parallel Islamist public sphere to coexist alongside the secular public sphere, which is, at least according to certain pictures of what's going on in Turkey, is withering day by day. So Erdogan is, as it were, trying to create this parallel Islamist public sphere, this parallel, a kind of alternative Islamist modernity, one might say. Why does this interest me? It interests me partly because I think this movement defies some common characterizations, some common misunderstandings of the Islamist movements around the southern Mediterranean and across much of the Middle East. According to this common understanding, the Islamist movements are a kind of reaction to globalization. You might be familiar with Benjamin Barber's rather simple-minded book called Jihad versus Macworld, a book that was published in 1996, in which his idea of the Islamist movements was that you have kind of American corporations slowly but surely conquering the world, okay, Macworld, as it were, and Islam as being this rebarbative kind of reaction, this defensive and rebarbative movement against this. Hence the title of his book, Jihad versus Macworld. This view of things was shared actually by many of my secularist friends in Turkey, so it was rather a common view of what these Islamist movements, whether we're talking about Tunisia or whether we're talking about Egypt or whether we're talking about Turkey or other places, there's a rather common view that this is what these movements are doing. By contrast, I think these Islamist movements are urban and urbane. They are imbued with a certain civic consciousness. They are very cosmopolitan, and they are extremely worldly wise. And they derive, I think, a significant amount of their strength, their political strength, and power and longevity from this very fact. So that interests me. Another thing that interests me is because music, I think, has actually been rather important. It's been rather important in creating and making believable the Islamic public sphere in Turkey as elsewhere. And I'm also interested in this topic because I think that music also shows up some of the problems in the performative making of this public space. Okay, the project here is to create an Islamist public sphere. And I think that when one looks about how people try and make that meaningful in musical terms, I think that one sees not only how this is fashioned in rather intricate detail, but also one comes to understand some of the problems, the contradictions, the issues that come up, and that then have to be resolved in some way. So one sees, I think, through music, in a rather interesting way, the making of a certain kind of public space. Now, to relieve you from the sound of my voice, I will show you some pictures, and we'll play you a little bit of music to give you some contextual sense of what I'm talking about. And these pictures culminate with some pictures of a concert that I want to talk about. I don't know how many people have visited Istanbul in recent years, but this is a space of tremendous transformations. It's a city that I've known for about 25 or so years, and the last 10 years have witnessed a very profound transformation of urban space. So one of these the aspects of this transformation is the reimagining of the city as the Ottoman metropolis. Okay, so this was something that the secular state was never very interested in, but the new Islamist municipality have restored all of the mosques, have restored all of the Ottoman heritage, even when in this case. I wanted you to see that's the HSBC bank there, inhabiting a nice little neo-Ottoman building, which is in fact a late 19th century Armenian, a bit of planned development, an area called Akarekle, which feeds up to Beşiktaş, for those of you who know. It's now been. So you see how the heritageization of Istanbul has gone hand in hand with the neoliberal transformation, actually. I think that's a rather neat picture there. And another picture here of an old Ottoman fountain. One of my music teachers used to live right next to that, and I used to walk past it day by day, and it was so covered in soot and rubbish that I didn't even realize that it existed. I just thought it was just an old bit of ruin. It was completely neglected until about 10 years ago. Somebody picked up some of the old bikes and bedspread, you know, bed frames and things, and said, oh, it's an old Ottoman fountain. And it was done up rather beautifully about 10 years ago. The Islamist transformation has been wrought on the bodies of women, of course, as in so many other parts of the Muslim world. And here we see a bit of Islamist fashion statement and Islamist consumerism in the very heart of the Islamist area in Istanbul, Fatih. Tuba is a big firm that deals in Islamist fashion. The transformation of cities takes place in the most powerful ways through eating habits and what's going into people's stomachs. And another enormous transformation of the city is that formerly buffets and little kiosks and small cafes would stay open during the month of Ramadan for those who couldn't be bothered or had given up or what have you. Now most things, more and more places tend to be closed, and we'll say, as this little buffet does here, we are closed for the month of Ramadan. And by contrast, the municipalities are competing with one another to put on lavish post-Ramadan celebrations. So of course you celebrate at the end of the day with eating and festivity and goodness knows what, and the municipalities are competing with one another to put on lavish spreads. And this is the kind of scene that one sees more and more as the time to break the fast comes up. These big soup kitchens, which have been put up by municipalities in these very public spaces. And this also was a scene that one didn't see quite so much, a more leisurely and convivial and informal scene where the taxi drivers here in Besiktas are just getting together to break the fast. Okay, taxi drivers of all people would have an excuse just to sort of keep drinking a little bit and keep eating a little bit because they're on the move. But these days, it seems everyone's fasting and everyone's breaking the fast at the same time. Ramazan, these pictures were taken in the middle of Ramazan in last September in Istanbul, has involved these ever more extravagant displays and performances organized usually by local municipalities, but other cafes and all sorts of people are getting in on the act. So you have things like what you see on the left there, which is a kind of dervish kitsch going on. To put on a performance, you see a whirling dervish whirling away there, and to a bunch of paying customers who are all gathered to break the fast together. And then on the right here, this is a poet who is declaiming poetry on religious themes. It was a long bit of poetry telling the story in Turkish of one of the companions of the prophets. And you can't see here, but he's being listened to by a simply enormous audience. Maybe 400 or 500 people are gathered just to listen to this guy declaiming poetry. These are very new sights and sounds in Istanbul. And moving now towards the particular person who interests me, but perhaps the most spectacular Ramazan shows are being put on in those areas of the city where the Islamist parties have their real power base, and this is at Baalarbashi, and this is a brand new building which has been put up by the municipality, a kind of conference center and display center, which is almost completely given over to religious activities. And this is one of the concerts that I went to, which is called the Minik Dualar Grubu, the Little Prayer Group, and they perform musically to rather sentimental popular music, just common prayers, as it were. And these were the great, great Turkish musical hit of last year. Now, let me talk about the person who has interested me more particularly than anybody else, a man called Mehmet Emin I, who more or less single-handedly created what I want to describe as a kind of Islamist popular music. This popular music is perhaps the most widely listened to music in Turkey at the moment. He's quite a well-known person. He was born in 1963 in the eastern city of Van. He migrated with his father at quite an early age to the western city of Bursa. He got a degree from the Faculty of Theology in Bursa, and he then did a doctorate. The subject of his doctorate was Islamic education amongst Turkish migrants in Western Europe. And he then got a job teaching in the Faculty of Theology at Bursa. So he's a theology professor. He's an academic, actually. This is, as it were, his day job. He started off his musical education as a Quranic reciter. He was a reciter of the Quran. His father was a Quranic reciter, introducing him through tapes to the main Istanbul Quranic recitation traditions. And Mehmet Emin I continues to broadcast daily Quranic recitation on the Turkish radio. And a small interesting fact here about how the mediascapes in recent years have been changing, this is exported to all of those parts of the world in Central Asia in particular, where the Turkish state has a kind of almost a sort of imperial interest. And Mehmet Emin I's recordings of the Quran are now, my understanding is, the basis for Quranic recitation in parts of the former Soviet Far East and in China to this day. So he's a very influential Quranic reciter. As I said, he invented more or less single-handedly in 1989 with a cassette called Talia al-Bedru Alayna, a kind of Islamic popular music. It goes by the name of Yeni Ilahi, or new hymns, I suppose you could say. This was marketed through a company called Bazar Yapım, which he operates together with a guy called Mustafa Demirci. These recordings are to be found all over Istanbul. If you see people selling cassettes and CDs on the street, you'll find a good number of his CDs. If you do just a brief surf using YouTube on the web, you'll find his stuff absolutely all over the place. How did this music become popular? Well, this music was picked up very quickly by youth in 1989. Young people, usually from poor backgrounds, who had found their way into this parallel schooling system established by the Islamist movement in Turkey. So these were basically Quranic schools. They called them Imam Hatip schools, which were very, very effective in providing basically poor people with an education. These people received not only an education, but a good education, which has meant that many of the graduates from those schools found their way into the best universities, and from the best universities into government jobs. So the current governing cadre in the Turkish political system are graduates from these so-called Imam Hatip schools. Now, these people were en masse, were Mehmet Emin Ay's fan base. Okay, this is where his music circulated to an extraordinary degree. This is actually how I encountered his music for the first time, having connections with these universities. People who are part of this world came up to me and said, hey, have you listened to this guy? He's really great. I think you're interested in music. You should listen to this. What do you think? It was all a way of just sort of drawing me into that space, of course, with the ultimate aim of converting me and what have you. It was a little bit like the equivalent of Jehovah's Witnesses giving you these kind of pamphlets and things like that. So the movements in question were for those of you who are familiar with this world, are the so-called the followers of Said Nursi, who was an Islamist thinker, quite a prominent Islamist thinker of the late 19th, the early 20th century. His followers are known as the Risale-i Nur Cemaati, or the Society of those who read the Risale-i Nur, which was his book, or they're known as the Nurcu. This is quite an old order. An offshoot of that order, I do want you to know about these people because they're quite important across not only the Mediterranean world, but in many parts of Europe and in America in particular, is the so-called Gülen movement. Fethullah Gülen was brought up with this spiritual and intellectual background, and Fethullah Gülen is the Turkish Billy Graham. He's a kind of televangelist. He was able to use the kind of emerging media systems to develop a style of preaching, basically, which used all of the old Islamic arts of preaching but adapted them to the televangelism format. He became a millionaire, a squillionaire, very, very quickly, and retired to Florida, but he remains a very important person. So the Risale-i Nur Cemaati and the Gülen movement and these provincial school kids from quite a poor background who were in the Imam Hatip schools in Turkey in the late 1980s and the early 1990s, now very much people of kind of, you know, a bit younger than me, but now people who really sort of occupy the administrative ranks of the currently dominant political order. So this, politically speaking and socially speaking, is what he appealed to, and what his fan base, as it were, is. Let me say something about his music. His music, importantly, has very little connection with past Islamic musical cultures. Turkey had, I have to say, in the past tense, a very rich and historically rooted set of musical practices associated with the Sufi orders in Turkey, with the Mevlevir, with the Halvetir, with the Cerrahiyye, and so on and so forth. The Secular Republic from 1923 onwards was aggressively militated against the Sufi orders, as I'm sure many of you are familiar. And therefore, the musical infrastructure, these were like music conservatories, these Sufi brotherhoods were like musical conservatories. And as these brotherhoods were increasingly marginalized by the secular state, the whole musical apparatus, the whole musical training system that these religious confraternities permitted became attenuated. They became reduced in size and shape and scope. So by the 1980s, very, very little of that musical culture survived. It survives today in the hands of old people, some amazing recordings, and a few people who hang on to these tiny, tiny traditions. But to all intents and purposes, in my view, as an ethnomusicologist, that musical tradition has more or less disappeared. So by 1980, then with the military coup of 1980, which affected even further repression of religious communities, it was really wiped off the landscape. So what happens to people in the late 1980s and the early 1990s who want to, as it were, reimagine, reinvigorate an Islamic music, meaningful in Turkish terms? They have to start from scratch. Okay? So this is one of the reasons why Mehmet Emin I and his music is so interesting and important to me, is that he's kind of having to invent it as he goes along. He has his Quranic background, that's very important, but what he lacks is this connection with the historically previously existing Sufi groups. What instead does he base his music on? Well, he bases it on the kind of enduring popular musical culture of Turkey, which is the popular musical culture of arabesque, which has interested me up until now as a purely secular phenomenon, but this is the kind of the religious engagement with this secular music. What is arabesque? The Turkish state did not like to think of itself as connected to the Arab world at all, so in the construction of a national culture, anything that was Arab was by definition bad and problematic. Okay, which meant that anybody who, as it were, objected to the secular state, which went about its business in a very authoritarian way, embraced everything that was Arab. And if it had an Arab flavor or an Arab taste to it, or if they'd been listening to it on Arab radio, on Lebanese radio, or on Cairo radio, it was fantastic, it was good. So this formed the basis of a kind of counterculture in Turkey in the late 1960s and throughout the 1970s, a musical culture which looked to the Arab world for its musical inspiration as a kind of protest. This music came to be known as arabesque. Mehmet Emin I is rather reluctant to call his music arabesque because there are very negative connotations. But when I ask him, you know, where are you getting the ideas for your compositions from? He says, well, I listen to Arab music. I listen to Umm Kulthum. I listen to Abdul Halim Hafiz. Muhammad Abdul Wahhab. I listen to Fairuz, I listen to, you know, all of these names known, of course, across the Mediterranean. But he's listening to them to, as it were, plunder their tunes and plunder their vocal styles to create his own music. So he very explicitly bases what he does on Arab models. And when we were in conversation, he took up his laptop and he said, look what I've got, all of Umm Kulthum. I've got all of Abdul Wahhab. I've got all of Abdul Halim Hafiz. And indeed, I looked, and they were there. He's got the whole lot. So he's very animated and very excited by what he calls that 1950s Egyptian sound. That's actually the term that he uses. This is what he's all about. What's important to this is some technical things. He's interested in the way in which they use mode, maqam. Okay, so the Arab maqam system is a little different to the Turkish maqam system. It's a difference of dialect, if you want. But for Turkish listeners, the Arab spelling, if you want, the Arab pronunciation, that's a better way of putting it, of maqam is affecting. It has a sort of sensitivity and an emotionality to it, which Turkish listeners find a little lacking in the Turkish pronunciation, which is very correct, and it's sort of theoretically has more integrity from that point of view, but it doesn't quite move in the same sort of way. So when he is performing, for those of you who are familiar with maqam, when he's performing in Hijaz or Hazam or maqams like this, he's always choosing, as it were, the Egyptian pronunciation of this rather than the Turkish or the Istanbulian pronunciation of this. What's very important is a quality of sensitivity. Duygusallık is the Turkish term. He says that's absolutely key to my music. It's a kind of sensitivity. I want to sort of touch people with this music, which again he feels able to do by using these Arab sounds. A third thing that I want to notice before I play it, because it's time for me just to play a little bit of this and talk a little bit about this concert, is that there's a kind of pedagogical bent to this. He's very interested in using his music I mean, he's very productive, musically speaking. He's made, in the last 10 years, he's made 50 recordings, 50 CDs. I mean, immensely productive. This stuff just pours out of the guy. There's a pedagogical inspiration here. He wants to teach the Muslim world about the Turkish contribution to Islamic culture. So he selects texts from Turkish mysticism, sometimes translated into Arabic. He likes singing in Arabic, and markets this stuff in the Arab world as a means of saying, look, we guys too made our contribution to, as it were, Islamic cosmopolitanism. Another part of the pedagogical bent of this music is that he's very interested in Turkish-speaking migrants in the Western European countries who he feels have lost their culture. Like many people of his background, he feels that they've somehow lost their culture and lost their religion and they're losing their language and so on and so forth. So he wants to, as it were, win them back, which he has to do by using a popular music and by being, as it were, soulful about the whole thing. So there's quite an explicit sort of pedagogical project, as well as an explicit, if you want, emotional project at play here. Now, I'm going to play you some of, maybe the first thing I should do is play you some of the music that concerns me, and then I want to talk about a concert very briefly that I attended. Thousands of praises be upon our Prophet and his family. You know that these are words of a prayer, of course. So Arabic and then Turkish. Kurdish. It's quite interesting. But very interesting. And so it goes on. You get French and I think Dutch. I think. Have you had German and then there's Dutch and then there's French? And that's, okay, it goes on. So the Islamist cosmopolite fantasy is, like all such fantasies, full of contradictions and problems which have to be managed. And the managing of these problems, I think, occurs in a very interesting sort of way in and through music. So I'd just like to, close by saying a few things about that. And I think where one can get at this, most interestingly as an ethnomusicologist, is to look at, rather than looking at something that is complete and finished and that went right, to look at something that went wrong. Okay. So what has been in my mind in recent months has been a concert of his that I attended, which went wrong in all sorts of ways. This was a concert in Balarbashir. It was at the end. It was in Ramadan last year, last September. These are some pictures that I took. Which shows you the audience in this rather smart concert hall. You'll see that they're mostly women. You'll see that they're mostly middle-aged. You'll see that they're mostly wearing hijab, not all of them, of course, but mostly wearing the conservative dress. This is the kind of band the kind of backing band that gets set up here. So you see the instruments: qanun, rhythm. Violin, rhythm again, a ney, which is a flute, and I think that is a piano keyboard at the back there. Here you see Mehmet Emin I has a partner with whom he works very closely. He it's really his producer, a man called Mustafa Demirci, and they perform together. So on the right you see Mustafa Demirci in the kind of silver suit. You see the band backing, and then on the right you see the two of them on stage together. Unfortunately, this picture didn't come out very well, but I wanted to capture an image which I think says something about the rather complex agencies at play in this world. It's a young woman wearing a hijab, sitting back and doing what everybody does in concerts these days, which is taking a picture on her mobile phone. And that, to me, says something rather important about the Islamist movement in Turkey and, of course, elsewhere. It's, as it were, the men on stage, but the support and the infrastructure for the whole thing is to a very significant degree. And very important kinds of agencies, I think, are actually coming from women. So you can see her, there she is sitting there, and you can see her just capturing the two of them with her cell phone. Right, so what went wrong in this concert? Nothing particularly disastrous. But when I went backstage to talk to the two of them, in their good-natured way, they were clearly very angry about how things had not worked out as they had intended. The first problem was with the sound. The sound technician had got the balance all wrong. First of all, it was too loud. It was making people uncomfortable, they said. It was just deafening people. You know, this isn't music to overwhelm people like that, and it was way too bad. Secondly, the balance between the musical instruments, the backing instruments here, and the singers was all wrong. Now, this is really crucial, and this is where religious sensitivities play a rather important role, because this music is all about the text. It's all about communicating the meaning of the words. And the moment that you have the person playing the drums and the person playing the keyboards actually making it difficult for you to hear those words, then a key argument in a Muslim context, where music is always problematic for exactly this reason, disappears. And they were very upset by the fact that the music technician, who was somebody that they didn't know, therefore not necessarily somebody who was actually part of the movement, in other words, couldn't be relied on to get that key fact, had really messed up in a rather important way here. So they went backstage and they were very frustrated and angry about that. The other thing that they were frustrated and angry about was the fact that there was a bit of energy lacking. They just felt, like all of us who perform on stage, you come off stage and sometimes you just know that things haven't gone quite right. A little buzz was kind of lacking. What I mean? And one of the reasons for this was that we were 14, 15 days into Ramadan. These are all observing people. They're following the fast really quite strictly. 14 days into Ramadan, you're exhausted. Everyone was tired. Everyone was fed up. You could see rings under people's eyes. This concert started at the moment of iftar, so the all of the people on stage hadn't even had a chance just to say their prayers and have a sandwich or a glass of tea or a cigarette or anything. You know? And that was a little bit true of the audience as well. It was flat. And so the problem here is, well, it's all very well putting on these great Ramadan festivities, but you're relying on people like us to, as it were, you know, bring the whole thing to life. But we can't do that. You know, it's really not kind of practical. You know, the practicalities just weren't being thought through here. I could see, so these were the ways in which they felt that the situation was a little bit problematic. These were things that they were representing them both to themselves and using me as an excuse to talk about, you know, Martin, don't you agree the sound was an absolute disaster? And I said, well, I don't really know, of course. But no, it was, wasn't it? You know, the backing musicians, they were all over the place and they were playing way too loud and, you know, we can't have this guy doing this again. Don't you think, Martin? You know, using me as to kind of, you know, say something that they might not have otherwise been able to have said. Now, another interesting contradiction that you see here is really how you kind of manufacture a kind of star culture in this world. This is very popular music. This guy is very well known. Almost anybody at least knows who this person is. And there's two very different ways of imagining how this might actually be turned into some kind of a performance in the secular spaces, as it were, of the modern republic. One is to act like a star. So Mustafa Demirci, you see, he has this kind of wonderful sort of silver outfit. And he's always moving to the front of the stage with his microphone and speaking to and singing to and addressing the audience. I mean, he's seeking that kind of communication, okay, like a pop music star in the Turkish context. Mehmet Emin I, on the other hand, just his body language was completely different. He was dressed all in black, okay, so very sober. And whereas Mustafa Demirci was always moving forward, he was always stepping back. Okay, whereas he was always seeking eye contact, Mehmet Emin I was always looking down. He actually had a music stand on the stage. It's quite unusual. He had a music stand on the stage, and he was as it were singing into the music stand, as a way of performing. I am not a performer. Right? It was a way of performing. This is about the message. This is about the musical culture. This is about trying to communicate spiritual values rather than, as it were, sort of embodied, charismatic presence. So that tension, I think, between stepping forward and performing and stepping back and, as it were, keeping on message, might be understood as, I think, a rather powerful contradiction at the heart of the Islamist movement, one that one might trace back actually to the kind of relationship, the political relationship between Erbakan and Erdogan that I was talking about a little bit earlier. This is a very important contradiction in the political face of the Islamist movement, which I think one can see being worked through and negotiated and attempting to be managed in the musical space. So this is one of the reasons, one of the many reasons, why I feel that an ethnomusicologist's take on the new shapes and the new faces of Islam in the public sphere and in mass media in countries like Turkey. But what I'm saying about Turkey might also, I think, be applied to some of the other Mediterranean Muslim countries is a fascinating topic. So I'd like to thank you very much for being here and listening to me.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Music and the Global Order. This talk was delivered by Dr. Martin Stokes.